Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to your leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Associate Editorial Director with Neurology Live. In this episode, we're going to give you a glimpse into our on-site conversations from four major medical meetings that we attended this June: the Consortium of MS Centers annual meeting, the annual Joint Sleep meeting, the second Advanced Therapeutics and Movement and Related Disorders Congress, and the American Headache Society's annual scientific meeting. So without further ado, let's dive in. Start things off with two experts that we sat down with at the Consortium of MS Centers annual meeting in Aurora, Colorado. First, we've got Dr. Amit Bar-Or, the Melissa and Paul Anderson President's Distinguished Professor at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, who co-chaired and presented a symposium about BTK inhibitors as a novel treatment approach for managing MS. We caught up with him to discuss the ongoing clinical study of this class of medicines. Here's some of what he had to say.
Well, the ongoing research on the clinical side, of course, involves the phase three clinical trial program. There are multiple BTK inhibitors now in advanced phase three clinical trials in relapsing, but also in progressive forms, both primary progressive MS and non-relapsing secondary progressive MS. So those are sort of the particularly exciting contexts of the greatest unmet need. I would add that we now understand that the biology of progression is not starting only when we see it in secondary progressive MS or primary progressive MS, but it's probably there under the surface for much earlier. So if these drugs prove to strike a good balance between efficacy, including relapsing biology, but also the progressive biology, and they end up being sufficiently safe and well tolerated, they will likely be relevant for people across the MS spectrum, from very early MS, potentially first line, all the way through to people with progressive forms of multiple sclerosis. So that's we need to get those results as far as the first next in terms of data. But there are other things that we would like to do. We'd like to show with other assessments that we're impacting with this class of therapies brain compartmentalized inflammation. For instance, looking at microglial activation with PET, positron emission tomography type imaging, which can actually assess at the level of individual cell types the activation state, and limiting that in regions of the brain that we think are involved not in the relapsing biology, but in the progressive biology would be further evidence to substantiate the potential of these therapies. We have a few things to learn on the safety side. We've had a signal with respect to potential hepatic injury, infrequent events where there are bumps in liver enzymes. This has happened to several of the BTK inhibitors, and their trial programs have been at least partially stopped by the FDA in terms of not recruiting further patients for a period of time or avoiding continued treatment in people who've not been on the drug for very long, because the observation to date is that if this happens, it tends to happen relatively early with the exposure. So if you've been on it for a while, for several months, maybe it's not going to be an issue. Some people develop this, some people don't. When people have and the drug has been stopped, it's been reversible, so people have not really run into major issues. And there have been cases where it has actually normalized even in the face of continued treatment. So we really need the phase three clinical trial data to understand how big an issue this is, and we will almost certainly be able to come up with a risk mitigation strategy, so we'll need to study that, and it may be that monitoring blood for the first period of time on this drug is a requirement as part of its marketing. Of course, everything depends again on pivotal trial data. So those are some of the questions that relate both to the clinical data that we're looking for in the next epoch, as well as some of the biomarker imaging data. There are other biomarker type studies that the field is very interested in the context of BTK inhibition. Can we use this type of treatment to impact biomarkers, finally having a treatment that may impact previously unattainable treatment goals of targeting progressive MS?
Next, we're going to hear from Dr. Gavin Giovannoni, a professor of neurology at Barts and the London School of Medicine and Dentistry, who gave a lecture at CMSC on dissecting the immunology of MS and what can be learned from it that can help in developing therapies for patients. Here's Dr. Giovannoni with his thoughts on the changing view of MS disease course.
You know, we have this model of MS being an autoimmune disease, and central to the pathogenesis of the disease is focal inflammation. Clinical relapses and these lesions that come and go. And I think that's probably wrong because we have very effective therapies now that can stop all that happening. But the disease still continues. You know, we're calling it smoldering disease. And you can see there's lots of posters and signs trying to make people aware that underneath the focal inflammation is a pathology going on that's causing people to get worse that we're not addressing. And that is quite a paradigm shift because I actually think that is the disease, and what's happening in terms of inflammation is in response to the disease. It's not the disease. There's something in the brain and the spinal cord, and our immune system's responding to it. That's my understanding. And because of that, we're going to have to develop new treatments, or we're going to have to develop combination therapies. And the new treatments are going to have to target some of the processes that are occurring in the brain and spinal cord. At the same time, as we're seeing those paradigms shifting, we also know that it's highly likely that MS is caused by Epstein-Barr virus, the virus that causes infectious mononucleosis. I think the epidemiology is overwhelming, and we have to do trials now to see if we can prevent MS by preventing people getting infected with EBV. And so that's why the pharmaceutical companies and even NIH are developing EBV vaccines, and one of their disease targets is prevention of MS. Saying that, though, the question is, how does EBV cause MS? And I think there's lots of evidence that it's the virus that's driving MS disease activity. In other words, it's what's causing MS to be active. And that means we've got to think about how do we target the virus. So there's a new paradigm emerging where we're wanting to do trials of antivirals, but also trials of immunotherapy. They work against Epstein-Barr virus. And I say this because almost all of our therapies in MS that are shown to work target the memory B cell, and that's where EBV resides in its latent state. There's one exception is teriflunomide, which doesn't actually have a big impact on it, on memory B cells. But it's a pan-antiviral, so it could be working as an antiviral. And actually, when you look at teriflunomide, it's a very interesting therapy. It doesn't really do much to focal inflammation. It reduces the attack rate by about 30-35%. But it has a big impact that is beyond what you'd expect it to have on disability progression, worsening MS. And similarly, it also has a big impact on brain volume loss, which is unexpected based on its impact on. So it disconnects the inflammation from the smoldering processes. So that's a clue as well. And I suppose the big news for me was that we presented new data at this meeting of a brand new compound. It's an anti-CD40 ligand, anti-CD40 ligand antibody, frexalimab. It's not a new pathway. I mean, we've known about this pathway for 30 years, I think. And you know, it's always been on the top, one of the pathways on the top of the list for immunologists. It's always popped up in the genomics. You know, it looks like it's a really important pathway in autoimmunity in general. And I'm just surprised it's taken so long to get a phase two trial, but the trial's very positive, you know, so we're very excited. So the high dose, you know, reduced disease activity by over 90%, and particularly took a bit of time, but, you know, particularly in the extension part of the study is really effective. So the exciting news is going to go forward now into phase three. But what's so exciting about this pathway is it doesn't only target T cells. The CD40 ligand is the co-stimulation to activate T cells, but it also down-regulates innate immunity, monocytes, macrophages, microglia, but it also suppresses B cell activity. So it's the first therapy that targets like all three components that have popped up in network analyses has been important in MS. T cells, B cells, and microglia. So that's really, really interesting. And there's also a little bit of biology. It also may work against Epstein-Barr virus. I mean, that's a hypothesis because EBV also uses CD40 ligand pathways to keep B cells alive. So that's all coming together in a nice story.
That's really exciting. And the other exciting thing is because CD40 ligand is considered to be such a pivotal part of the immune system, we would have expected that if you block that pathway, you're going to get lots of infections, lots of side effects, adverse events, particularly the infectious ones. And we didn't really see that in the study. You know, so the infectious complications are, the signal's very low, and people got COVID, for example, and recovered very well. So it's telling us that the immune system has got a lot of redundancy, and despite us expecting to see an infection signal, we didn't see a big one. So I'm, you know, extremely excited by the fact that this is going to go forward into phase three. So this is a new class of compound, and it's exciting.
Now we're going to head off to Indianapolis, Indiana, to hear from a couple of experts who spoke with us at the annual SLEEP meeting, which is the Joint American Academy of Sleep Medicine and Sleep Research Society meeting. First, we're going to hear a snippet of our conversation with Dr. Dana Johnson, who's a sleep epidemiologist and assistant professor at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University, who was also named this year's APSS Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Leadership Award winner. She spoke with us about the ongoing and multi-level efforts to address modifiable factors of sleep health for the overall population. Here's Dr. Johnson with more.
We call that, it's really thinking about multi-level factors. And so there are things at the individual, the household level, community, neighborhood, and societal that we all can do, right? So some of them are more challenging than others. And so one of the first things that, you know, I think is most important is using our voice and our platform to really raise awareness around sleep health, but also sleep injustices, right? And so that's a good point to start with, or a good start. The other piece is thinking about how we can modify some of our recommendations to fit to communities that are disadvantaged. For example, in terms of our healthy sleep recommendations, we say to sleep in a dark, quiet room. But we know everyone can't do that because of safety issues. So adjusting the recommendation to say, put a light on in a hallway or somewhere else in the house, so we don't compromise someone's sense of safety in promoting good sleep health. And so as we talked about, there are environmental factors. And so especially for clinicians, we can really try and collect more data on social determinants of health. So knowing where someone lives, we can get their zip code, and then we're able to understand more about their environment, which may tell us their risk level for having sleep apnea, for example, or even insomnia or other sleep disorders. So being able to collect data on social determinants, in addition to just screening for sleep disorders in the community, right? So that's a community level intervention, placing sleep specialists in the community, partnering with organizations that are doing health fairs, so we screen for sleep disorders in the environments that really need it most, that are most at risk.
Next, we're going to hear from Dr. John Winkelman, the Chief of Sleep Disorders Clinical Research Program at Massachusetts General Hospital. He spoke with us about the paradigm of care in restless leg syndrome and how the field is seeking to move away from dopamine agonists as first-line therapies. Here's Dr. Winkelman with his thoughts.
Until recently, the past couple of years, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, American Academy of Neurology had used or indicated that dopamine agonists were first-line treatment. That is no longer true. The RLS Foundation, and soon to be the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, will indicate that dopamine agonists are not first-line treatments. And the reason they're no longer first-line treatments is there's now substantial evidence that dopamine agonists, when used for restless leg syndrome, are associated with an augmentation of RLS symptoms, a worsening of the underlying disorder due to the medication. The last thing we would want as doctors to happen to our patients is that our treatments are making them worse. So, in the absence of dopamine agonists as a first-line treatment, what are our alternatives? Well, alpha-2-delta calcium channel ligands, such as gabapentin, pregabalin, gabapentin, enicarbil, as well as iron treatments are now first-line therapies. Iron treatments, either oral or IV iron, are only appropriate for people who have what I would call relative iron deficiency. RLS is a brain state of low iron. And we don't have access to brain iron in the clinic. We get serum indices of iron. And a number of studies have demonstrated that oral iron or IV iron is effective for RLS in patients who have ferritins, let's say about, not exactly, below 75.
Next, we're going to travel to Washington, D.C. to the second annual Advanced Therapeutics in Movement and Related Disorders Congress, where we sat down with a number of movement disorder specialists. First, we're going to drop in on some of our conversation with Dr. Laxman Baru, the Professor of Neurology and Residency Program Director at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital, who spoke in a series of masterclass sessions that covered everything from the basics of botulinum toxin use to hands-on practice with injections. Here's Dr. Baru in his words on the importance of this class of medicine in Parkinson's disease.
So botulinum toxins are an exciting class. They've been with us for about 25, almost 30 years. But the interesting thing about it is that the use has expanded with new indications coming up, new formulations have come up. All of that has made an understanding of botulinum toxins kind of vary depending on when you trained, comfort level. And unlike oral medications, this class of medications is more needy, hands-on, more delicate in the sense that there are multiple steps to becoming a successful injector, understanding the disease state, being comfortable with anatomy, being able to be comfortable with setting expectations with patients. I think that's a very important component of it. If we don't set expectations with our patients that are realistic, our patients set expectations that may or may not be achievable. So setting those expectations, then being able to deliver and work towards those expectations is incredibly important. So if you look at it, this understanding from clinicians varies from very little understanding to, you know, expert level understanding and everybody in between. And what makes it interesting is that we have this therapy that works when oral medications do not, to be able to manage symptoms like spasticity, sialorrhea, dystonia. And that's an important component for us to use in our armamentarium for our patients. When you look at Parkinson's patients, many Parkinson's patients have a variety of conditions that can be managed with botulinum toxins. It's one more aspect of their management that we have to do. And maybe that's why they don't get the attention they deserve, because so much of our attention is pulled with motor symptoms or non-motor symptoms or a variety of other discussions. We're talking about balance, we're talking about dyskinesias, we're talking about off time. And there's so many options there, and there's so much discussion there, plus the non-motor issues of cognition, depression, among other things, that take away and our time from the full discussion of Parkinson's. I'm not saying they should not get the attention they deserve. Obviously, what should take our attention from our patients is what is important, right? What our patients present with. Some of our patients present with a lot of important issues with motor issues, and that should be addressed. So what we should talk about, what's important for our patients, is what should determine the time we spend. Some patients have issues with motor issues and falls and dyskinesias, and that should take primary focus. Other individuals may have some of those issues, but there may be unmet needs for non-motor issues. Sometimes non-motor issues such as sialorrhea can be incredibly bothersome. Years ago, there was a list published of the top 10 symptoms that Parkinson's patients are bothered by. Do you know tremor and falls were the top two in the 10? Those are the only two motor symptoms. The rest were all non-motor, and sialorrhea made it in the top 10 list of non-motor or list of symptoms that were bothersome. That can be managed with botulinum toxin. Individuals often suffer from dystonia, whether that's painful dystonia of the limb or dystonia of the neck, and some advancing Parkinson's patients will develop dystonia such as blepharospasm. That can be managed with injections. So being proficient in managing movement disorders would also mean having some level of proficiency in botulinum toxins, whether that is being able to recognize the disease state and getting them to somebody who can help them, or recognize the disease state, set expectations, and treating yourself.
Second from ATMRD, we're going to hear a snippet of our conversation with Dr. Lingwan Albert, an assistant professor of occupational therapy at the New York Institute of Technology, who presented data at the meeting on the staggering effect that social isolation can have on the cognitive performance of patients with Parkinson's disease. Here's Dr. Juan Albert with more on those findings.
So I think it is important that we in the clinical community to educate patients how important it is to maintain their social participation as long as possible, as they can as possible. Patients usually come to the neurologist and complain about their motor aspects. the challenge in walking, balance, freezing, and all those very visible conditions. But they may not mention about, or more important, they are not even aware of the change in terms of cognitive function. And because of all those motor aspects that might be happening, they have a tendency to avoid going out to be social unless they feel they have to or they feel they are obligated to attend certain events. They also tend to avoid any social eating. They used to go out with friends, right? Meet in a restaurant and have a good time. Now, this is not necessary. I'm going to skip this one, right? Over time, over a couple more years, they are going to skip more and more social participation opportunities and then become more isolated. And from our literature review, we learned that even though so decreasing in social participation is not the cause or may not have a direct relationship to cognitive decline. However, theoretically, it makes a lot of sense that if you don't see people, you try to isolate yourself, it might cause earlier cognitive decline, especially in the social aspect. A couple of studies that we find that they discuss about specifically the executive function in problem solving in a social situation. People with PD may tend to have difficult time to recognize indirect or sarcastic comments, right? Or slow down in processing of communication and social interaction. Also because of their mask face, which is the decreased facial movement when they are talking to people or expressing themselves, that could be easily mistaken by not showing interest, right? So there are lots of going on because of the motor aspect affecting their social aspects in their life in general. And we really want to do whatever we can to minimize that happening if possible.
Finally, to close things out, we're going to head down to Austin, Texas, to the American Headache Society's annual scientific meeting, where we sat down with many experts in the care of headache and migraine. But the first of those you're going to hear from today is Dr. Sarah Pavitt, the chief of headache at UT Austin Dell Children's Hospital, who co-created the International Pediatric Headache Didactic Series. She spoke with us to discuss the current level of universal knowledge about pediatric headache for neurologists and non-specialists. Here's Dr. Pavitt with more.
Headache is the most common neurologic symptom that presents to the physician's office. So every type of physician, no matter if you're in neurology or outside of neurology, you're going to see these patients. Migraine tends to come with a lot of other comorbid conditions. So if you might be seeing a gastroenterologist for irritable bowel syndrome, and that patient might also have migraine. So when we think about training and educating, it's really trying to educate the masses as much as we can. When I think about educating different groups of people, I do feel like there are kind of essential components that everyone should learn about. Really, that's identification and diagnosing migraine and feeling comfortable in the diagnosis, given how common it is. And then understanding how to approach acute treatment, so what to do during a migraine attack. And then how do we think about starting preventive treatment? And how do we enact that? What are our options? What can we do? I think the other aspect that's really important is having a sense and learning about migraine epidemiology, understanding how common it is and how disabling it can be. We know it's the second most disabling disease worldwide. So understanding how that can impact your patients and then how as physicians can we identify that and help them move forward and improve their ability to function.
And finally, we'll wrap things up with some of our conversation with Dr. Ali Azadi, the director of the Neuroinformatics Program at the University of California, Irvine, who presented research at AHS on using data-driven approaches to identify naturally occurring clusters among participants with migraine. Dr. Azadi shared his perspective on the use of machine learning models to improve treatment optimization in heterogeneous migraine. Here's that in his words.
As a field in general, we know that migraine is a very heterogeneous disease, and by that, I am mainly referring to the fact that there is substantial within person and between person differences that we see. Even in one single person, a medication that works today might not work tomorrow because the type of migraine or essentially symptoms that they have is differing from time to time. And this heterogeneity leads to different problems for both patients and us as clinicians and researchers. And those are those can be categorized into diagnostic problems because we might not have the accurate diagnosis of diseases and we only have so many subtypes defined by the guidelines that we can put people in those bins. And it also causes, when the diagnosis is not accurate, it causes trouble with the therapeutic aspect of it too. So basically heterogeneity is causing a problem from the beginning to the end of disease. And the problem that we face and we see that on a day-to-day basis is that most of the drugs that are even approved by FDA are only effective in a small population of patients, and none of the drugs are actually more efficacious than 60-70%. So that has been a challenge and the main reason that we have started this line of research.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, you can visit neurologylive.com.